in Jonah, as we all are aware. Now, for those of you who are in Greek, Alexander's famous horse, Bucephalus. It means ox head. Now, the reason that Alexander really loved this horse was that when he was 13 years old, he observed that no one could break it. No one could ride it. And he told his father, "I want that horse." And his father said, "No one can ride it." And he said, "I can." And he said, "I'll pay for it if I can't ride it." To everyone's surprise, he got on the horse and he rode it and rode it and rode it and had no problem whatsoever. But he had observed something about the horse that no one else had noticed. It was afraid of the shadow of the rider. So he went riding into the sun, and then when he was firmly in control of the horse, that was the point where he turned around. No one else had noticed that the horse was afraid of the shadow of the rider. But it was Bucephalus, and you'll see this painting, which is a mosaic, which is a famous one of it, and there are statues and all sorts of stories about Bucephalus. As we look at the book of Jonah, it looks to man as though what God accomplished through Jonah would be absolutely impossible. Here we have one man showing up at the doorstep of the strongest world empire of its day. And amazingly, they respond to his message. But then just as amazingly, Jonah is upset. He's unhappy that they have done so. But of course, as we've seen, Jonah, when he was commissioned by God to deliver a warning to Nineveh, thought, God is a gracious God, and when God gives warnings, he's saying, I really want people to change. And Jonah didn't want for Nineveh to be spared. He was aware of prophecies that said what Nineveh's role would be in regard to Israel. And we remember how God told him to go to Nineveh, but instead he tried to go to Tarshish. And of course, as he got on the boat, a great storm came up. The boat was threatened with sinking, and all of the sailors started praying to their gods. Then the chief rope puller noticed that Jonah was not only not praying, but he was sound asleep in the bottom of the ship. So he said, "What's doing, pal?" Didn't quite say it in those words, I'm sure. But he came up to him and said, "Why aren't you praying? Pray to your gods that we might be spared." So then soon they cast lots because the storm was getting worse and worse and worse. And the lot fell on Jonah. And so they started to interrogate Jonah. "Who are you? Where are you from? Why is it that this great storm is upon us? I mean, what have you done?" And Jonah said, "Well, I am a Hebrew, a worshiper of the God who made the dry land and the sea." He also told them that he was trying to run away from God. And here he's proclaimed that God is in charge of everything, and yet he thinks he can escape from God. Well, the men were afraid, and they didn't know what to do because they thought, well, what if God really wants this man alive, not dead or alive? And they're thinking, well, if God is able to control events as he has, they want to make sure that God really wants this man dead. But Jonah's prophecy of saying, "Throw me into the sea and it will become calm for you," was a true prophecy. And lo and behold, when they threw him over, it suddenly became calm. But now for Jonah, he's spinning around and he visits the bottoms of the mountains and he gets tangled up in the seaweed and his very life was choked out of him. But as that was happening, he gave his initial prayer. And it was one where he expected deliverance from the Lord. Then he prayed from within the belly of the fish. And he made vows, vows of thanksgiving that he was going to fulfill in the temple because God had delivered him. He knew that he was rebellious and he knew that God wanted him to minister in the way that God had said for him to do so in Nineveh. And he knew that in running away, he had incurred a death sentence. But he saw that God was gracious. So, at this stage in his life, this man who had been a faithful prophet is ready to listen to the Lord once again. Let's break in at Jonah chapter 3, verse 1. God commanded Jonah to go to Nineveh to preach judgment against it. That's chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time, saying, Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and preach to it the message that I tell you. So once again, we have a second time. The wording here is the same wording that we have in Jonah 1:1. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, and then we have the proclamation against Nineveh. Now, Jonah had caught the ship from Joppa on the Mediterranean Sea down west of Jerusalem. He needs to traverse about 550 or 600 miles in order to get to Nineveh. He has a long way to go. That is north of Baghdad. I'll show you a map that's modern in order to give an idea. Here, the city circled in red near northern Iran is around Mosul. Mosul, you hear often on the news. And it's across the river from the ruins of Nineveh. Baghdad is circled with the blue circle, so it's considerably further south. But Mosul makes the news quite a bit. That's the destination that Jonah has. And he has a long distance to go. It's approximately 600 miles that he needs to travel. And he's been through a rather harrowing experience. And we'll find out a little bit more about his physical condition as we continue to unfold this book. Let's now look at verse 3. Jonah went, as the Lord commanded, to Nineveh, a city that God regarded as great, a three-day visit type of city. You may wonder a little bit about my wording here, but we'll clarify this as we go on. Jonah went, as the Lord commanded, to Nineveh, a city that God regarded as great, a three-day visit type of city. Let's read verse 3. So Jonah arose and went to Nineveh according to the word of the Lord. Now Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, a three-day journey. And then you'll notice it's in italics in extent. I don't think that that's the right interpretation, what they have added in italics. We'll explain why. That's a common view, but I just don't think that's the way that this is meant. So as we notice, God has graciously allowed Jonah another opportunity to obey. He could have written him off and said, you're disobedient, no second chances. But even though Jonah has needed reminders all along the way, God is still graciously working with him. Remember how the sailors said, pray to your gods. And then When he was in the water, he remembered the Lord, and he prayed. And when he was in the fish, he prayed. Jonah is one who has gotten a little sideways, and he's needing a lot of reminders here about the Lord. But the Lord is graciously continuing to work with him. Just as he is graciously working with the northern kingdom of Israel, even though that northern kingdom has gotten a long, long, long way away from the Lord. Well, Jonah obeys this part of God's instruction. He goes to Nineveh. Now, we haven't gotten into his message. We haven't gotten into what he's going to say. But at least in the first part, observe that we are told that he arose and went to Nineveh according to the word of the Lord. So as Jonah is writing this, he's saying, I followed instructions this time around. He didn't the first time, but he's saying, I did follow them now the second time. Now we have here that it's an exceedingly great city, a 3-day journey. And we need to ask the question, what does it mean, a 3-day journey? Let's look at a few slides. And it might be good, Ricardo, you might hit the other bank of lights because we've got several slides and this might be easier to see. So just hit this middle one. Nineveh was a great city. Now here we have mounds at Nineveh. Now they look like low hills, but they are mounds. They are not hills. These are man-made, and they are from ancient times. What we are looking at is the remains of a former fortification. Things decay, they break down, and gradually it starts looking like just hills. Off in the distance, you see something that's a little more squared. That's modern. And that's a reconstruction of the gate, or one of the gates, here at the city of Nineveh. But we have an extensive line of these mounds that goes around the city. And it's saying where the walls were. Now, if you look at this one, may be a little difficult to pick it out. But along the horizon, you'll see that there are mounds the whole width of this picture. But in the center section, there has been a restoration of the wall. This is showing you that it's a pretty extensive set of fortifications that there were around this city. We're looking at a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of labor, all done by hand to build these fortifications for this city. It's giving you an idea. This is a pretty important city. Now, there is a larger mound and there's a smaller mound here at Nineveh. And the smaller one has an interesting name. His name is Nabi-Yuna. Any guess what that means? Nabi-Yuna. The prophet Jonah. They say, how did a place in Iraq get the name the prophet Jonah? Nabi-Yuna. Now, I don't know how it got its name, and I don't know when it got its name. I don't know if it got its name way, 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 way back when. But you know how mountains don't really change their names real fast. I mean, mountains or, and you look around here and this is all flatland. And now you have mounds. And these mounds were where there were walls. Those don't just haphazardly pick up a name and have people stick with it. I'm not just sure how it got its name, but you have to wonder if this is talking about, yes, indeed. There was a certain prophet, and he came here, and he made a prophecy about this place. Now, let's look at a few more pictures. This shows that the mounds that you can see as you're looking inward over the restored wall really are not hills. You can see the shapes, the foundations. These are the ruins of buildings. These are the ruins of a city. And what you see below on the left-hand side is a restored portion of the wall. But this that we're looking at up above, that has vegetation and everything else around it, that off from a distance looks just like it's hills, is actually the remains of ancient buildings, the remains of the city. Now you can see we have a modern city here, and we have an expressway off on the right-hand side and so forth. So one of the concerns here is that as the city of Mosul grows, that they're going to be starting to look at this as prime real estate. Now it's kind of interesting how all this restoration work happened. We have Saddam Hussein to thank for that, because Saddam wanted to prove to everyone that he was going to restore Iraq to its former glory, and so he was busy building all sorts of restorations of all sorts of things during the glory days of Assyria and Babylon in order to prove how great he was and what he was going to accomplish. I don't think he was a very good prophet. But we have him to thank for all of these restorations. Now here's one of the gates, the Shamash Gate. And now as you look on, you see more mounds. And you can see how there's city on the one side, there's settlement on the other, there's the river, and so on and so forth. And they had to widen this gate in order to make allowance for the roadway that goes through here. And these pictures were all taken in 1990, so not everything's in exactly the same shape today as it was back then. You'll notice here a concrete frame, and then they put the facing to try to make it look antique. But they haven't used entirely ancient techniques for rebuilding the walls, but the objective is to have it look ancient. But again, you can see the mounds, which are man-made, some of which is going to be as a result of decaying of buildings. Others may have been just reinforcement for the walls that was behind it. And here we have the Mashki Gate at Nineveh. This is up in the northwestern portion and, of course, reconstructed. Some of the stones at the very bottom are ancient stones that were in place, but everything on top of it has been built in modern times. And here we have ruins at Nabi Yunus. The prophet Jonah. So it's a very, very interesting place here as we look at this. God says it's a great city, and it's a great city from his perspective. God regarded it as a great city, and so therefore Jonah needed to go there. But what does it mean that it says it's a three-day journey? Well, clearly, since Jonah didn't have a Cessna, he didn't even have a Yank tank, he didn't have any means of rapid transit, for him to travel 600 miles, there is no way that that's a three-day journey. If you're looking at a leisurely pace, not pushing it too hard, 15 to 17 miles in a day, well, it's going to take him a lot longer to get there. If he traveled by horse or by camel, he might get there a little faster, but it's going to take him a fair amount of time to arrive there. Okay, so what does it mean it's a three-day journey? Well, some people have thought, oh, this city is big, this city is huge. This city is so huge that it takes 3 whole days to go around the city. Or it takes 3 whole days to get through the city because the walls are so big. Well, that doesn't work either. Here's a map of it. It's 7.3 miles around the wall. So he could go around that 3 times in a day. So this 3-day journey is still a mystery. Well, there's been another thought, and this thought has been, oh, well, outside of the walls, there were just suburbs and suburbs and suburbs, you know, thinking like modern cities, and saying, well, look at how long before you get into Los Angeles city limits, you're in the Los Angeles area. And they're thinking, okay, well, maybe it's that it takes 3 days to get across the whole urban area. Okay, well, that's a nice theory. But let's test it out. Let's imagine that it's this big area, and he has to go 3 days into urban area before he gets to the city. Well, if that's what it means, then we have a real big problem just a little bit further down in the passage. Look at verse 4. And Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk. That means, first day, he's in the city. He's not way out in the hinterlands saying, well, I've got 2 more days that I've got to go until I get to the city. So that's not what it means. Well, it's kind of like this. This is kind of an old picture here. But this was when President Fox of Mexico and his wife came to the White House for a state dinner, and then they transacted business, state business between the United States and Mexico. How much business do they transact when they're having this big fancy dinner the first day? None. Then the next day, all of the ambassadors get together, all the negotiators get together, and they are hashing things out. And then at the end of it, you have a signing ceremony saying, we've got this big new treaty. Minimum, 3-day visit. What you're looking at with important visits is there are preliminaries, then you take care of some of the business, then you have some of the closing things that are taken care of at the end. It's saying, Jonah, don't look at this as a little thing where you breeze into town and you say, hey, God's going to destroy this place in 40 days. There's going to be protocols. There are ways to handle things because they're going to look at you and they're going to see you coming in from some foreign country. They've got to find a translator who's going to be able to understand what you're saying. They've got to size you up and figure out if you're really speaking truth, if you really know what you're talking about, or if you're just someone who happened to blow into town and you've got some wild theory. They're going to take their time to assess you, and then things will go through the lower channels, and they'll gradually work their way up, and they'll say, okay, let him come in and see the ambassador. Now we'll talk a little bit. What is it that you have on your mind, Jonah? And then it's going to take some time for all this to transpire. He's being told, you need to go through all the steps because this is an important place and all the protocols are going to be followed. It's a 3-day visit. I think Douglas Stewart, in the Word Biblical Commentary on this portion of the Minor Prophets, has stated it well. He said, Nineveh was a 3-day visit city, a major diplomatic center of the ancient world, a city where formal protocol was observed by official visitors, whose business could not be accomplished hastily as if it were a small town. And that, I would say, is the most satisfactory answer here. God is saying, this is a great city. This is a great enough city that you're going to take your time and you're going to make sure to go through the proper channels so that your message is heard. It's not you blow into town and you say to the first person you meet, God's going to destroy this place in 40 days. Bye, I just said what God wanted me to say. He's saying, you go about this the right way, you make it before the proper officials, and we'll go from there. I think God's telling Jonah, you tried to slip out on a boat first time. I've got my eyes on you. I'm going to make sure you do this one the right way. Here's how it gets done. Well, in verse 4, we have the day that Jonah entered Nineveh. And he proclaimed to a lower official that Nineveh would be destroyed in 40 days. I'll explain in a later verse how it is that we know that he spoke to a lower official. He did not speak to the king. He did not have an audience with the king. But he's there. He made a proclamation that Nineveh would be destroyed in 40 days. Verse 4 reads, And Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk. And he cried out and said, Yet 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown. This is what he said in an official meeting. This is where he's in front of someone who's able to translate what he says and get it to the proper official who screens things for the king so that the king isn't having to meet with everyone who just happens to come by. Well, let's see what happens here in verse 5. The people of Nineveh believed God that he would destroy Nineveh. So they proclaimed a fast, and everyone put on sackcloth. That's in verse 5. So the people of Nineveh believed God. They proclaimed a fast and put on sackcloth from the greatest to the least of them. Now, we notice that it says that they believed God. And a lot of people have wanted to say, Jonah gave them the gospel. Jonah told them how to get everlasting life. Do we have any evidence that that was what God had sent Jonah to tell them? We have no evidence whatsoever. They believed God, that is, God is going to destroy this city. Now, just like nobody thought that a young boy, 13 years old, was going to be able to ride Bucephalus. But how is it that this one prophet from 600 miles away walks into town, has a meeting with a lower official, and before you know it, the whole city is stirred up, and they're saying, yeah, this is right. God's going to destroy the city. How did that happen? I'm glad you asked. That was a good question. Well, the first thing here is Jonah didn't look like your ordinary prophet. He just didn't look ordinary. After all, he had been exposed to stomach juices of a fish or a whale or something for a period of time. And acids like that just don't really work very well with the skin. People who have had those types of experiences are, they have some real problems that develop. It does a real number on the pigments that protect against the sun. And just think, Jonah is going to Iraq. They've got lots and lots and lots and lots of sun, as we know from all the people that were there in our military and are still there. His appearance was changed. He's not going to be able to handle the sun. He would have had tremendously bad burns all over his body. He's got real, real problems. Can you imagine what he looks like? I mean, he looks like death warmed over. I mean, he looks pretty bad. And here he is coming into town, and they're saying, "What on earth, or shall we say, what under the water happened to you?" And they're saying, "This guy looks like death warmed over." And indeed he was. Because that sign of Jonah was someone who died and was raised from the dead. And I think that he kind of looked that way too. But then, you know, I've said this is in the year 759 BC, and I haven't given any proof thus far, have I? I mean, I've just been saying that's when it was. And I've said, you know, that general time frame is here when we have Jonah because of his ministry during the reign of Jeroboam II of Israel. Okay, well, let's start adding up some of this information. This is an interesting book. Everyone disagrees with Edwin Tilley's dates to some degree. There's nobody that 100% agrees with Edwin Tilley, including Edwin Tilley. I'll show you here if I can. Well, let's see. Unfortunately, title pages lie. This is about his 12th edition. So he kept changing his mind, and every time he'd change his mind, he'd come up with a new edition. So I've been gradually collecting editions, and right now we own about 5 of his editions. Because what happens is anytime you go studying this, someone says, well, Tilley changed his mind between edition 6 and edition 7 on this date. And so you can find out his old reasons for his earlier date and his new reasons for his new date, and then you just have to look at all the editions if you want to figure out where he changed his mind everywhere. There are some other books that I can recommend that I think handle the dates better. Eugene Merrill, Kingdom of Priests, and Eugene Merrill for his historical survey of the history of Israel. But this book has the Assyrian eponym list, which is a really fascinating calendar. You know how the Chinese don't number their years, but they have the year of the dog and the year of the pig and the year of the chicken and so on and so forth? Well, in Assyria, they didn't number their years either. So they had the year of this person or the year of that person or the year of the other person and so on and so forth. So you could run into something that said, yeah, this happened late in the year of so-and-so, and you say, when was that year? So it's a really handy thing that this eponym list, this list of all the people's names for all the years, showed up. And there's one event that has really helped in terms of being able to figure out what the dating scheme is. And that is that there was a complete solar eclipse in Nineveh. And we can date that right down to the second. But it was on June 15th, 763 BC. There was a complete solar eclipse mentioned in the official records. And then a solar eclipse was a rather scary thing. Now let's look at what's going on here when it decides to move. There we go. We have the sun completely blocked out by the moon. And what's happening on the right-hand side is it's showing how the moon passes between the sun and the earth, and then you have a spot on earth that is completely blacked out, that all you have is the corona, that light that's shining around the edge of the sun. Now, from the Mir space station, they got a different view of a solar eclipse, looking at the shadow that is cast on planet Earth by the moon. At the same time that these documents talk about that solar eclipse, documents started circulating around the government of Assyria that were saying that because of this event, it's evidence that the king will be deposed. And they were worried about foreign invasions. They were worried about all sorts of things. This had happened 4 years before Jonah showed up. They have a solar eclipse. They're getting kind of nervous. They're saying, you know, things are kind of going wrong here. Furthermore, there was a great earthquake that hit during the reign of a king named Ashur-den. Now, there were a couple of kings with this name, but scholars, as they look at the details, are pretty comfortable to say that it's the one that occurred during the time of Jonah's lifetime. And let's see, I have a typo here. It should be 760 instead of 670 B.C. So that would be the likely date for that. Now you wonder, when you're looking at Nebi Yunus, and you see this huge statue of a king's head toppled on its side, you have to wonder, did Jonah see that? You know, when did that topple over? I don't know when it toppled over, but there was a great earthquake here. And if it were dated around 760, which would be when scholars are comfortable in saying that they think that it probably was about that time, and the scholars that are saying this are not all conservatives. There are a lot of liberal scholars that are looking at the evidence and saying, looks like that's about when it happened. Furthermore, there were revolts during the seven-year period of time before 759. There were revolts all over the country. And they were fighting a defensive war. They had moved out of being on the offensive. Prior to that, they were on the offensive, but now the country of Urartu, which was just north of them, was on the move, and they were losing territory to them. Now, that red circle is around Nineveh, that red circle at the bottom, and Urartu is this big yellowish area. They're not all that far from Nineveh. These people are getting nervous because they're not able to launch military campaigns, and they normally are on the move. They're having to be on the defensive. They're losing territory to this powerful nation that's growing at their expense just north of them. Then there's been this great earthquake, and there's been this solar eclipse. And on top of that, they were having famines and plagues in the general vicinity of Nineveh. And then death warmed over walks into town. Has God been preparing the way for Jonah to come here? Jonah came into town. He made his proclamation. And then things seemed to have settled down. And King Ashurden moved westward to Gozan, and things became quiet again. They stopped having as many problems as they had been having, especially for this 7-year period of time. That's why it looks like it was the year 759. That's when things all of a sudden settle down, and the nervousness has ended. Now, let's take a look at verse 6. After word of what Jonah is saying had spread through the city, the king in Nineveh, do notice that I said in Nineveh, also joined in the mourning. So he also joined in putting on sackcloth and mourning. Let's read verse 5, then we'll read 6. So the people of Nineveh believed God, proclaimed a fast, and put on sackcloth from the greatest to the least of them. Then word came to the king of Nineveh, and he arose from his throne and laid aside his robe, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat in ashes. It is important to notice the grammar of this passage says, verse 6 happened after verse 5. We have a citywide response to what Jonah has said, and then the king finds out about it. And the king says, good idea. Let's deal with a little problem first. He's called the king of Nineveh. And a lot of people have had a lot of difficulty with that. And that's because Nineveh is the name of a city, it's not the name of a country. But it just means that he is the king who happens to be there. He's the king in that place. It really was not the official capital of Assyria. The capital kind of moved around for a period of time. But Ahab is called the king of Samaria. And at that time, Samaria was not the name for a country, it was only the name for the capital of the nation of Israel. Same thing happened with Ahaziah. And then with Ben-Hadad, he was called king of Damascus. Damascus, again, is a city, but the name of the country is Syria, or Aram, as it was then called. There's no problem here. It's just that the king governed Assyria from Nineveh. He's the king that's in Nineveh. Now, as we noted, he moved to Gozan, and later on he came back to Nineveh. So there could have been other records that would have said the king in Gozan, or the king of Gozan. Well, it's just a way of referring to him. He's the king that's there. It's not saying that there's no knowledge that Nineveh is anything other than the name of a city. Okay, let's read between the lines. Why is it that the king has this response after there's a citywide response to Jonah's message? I think what happened was Jonah went and he talked to a lower official. And the lower official said, I'll make sure to pass this through the proper channels. And he's thinking, there's been this earthquake. There's been this solar eclipse. Here's death walked over, death warmed over, coming into my presence. And we've had famines, and we've had plagues, and we've been losing wars, and we've been having to quell revolts in city after city. The past 7 years have been utterly chaotic, and Urartu is on the move. And he probably said to his brothers, hey, you've got to tell your families. And told his wife, told his friends. And so besides going up the official channels, it started going through the gossip columns, and it made its way through the city. And the king is the last one to find out. This is a fairly compact city. It's not going to take a lot of time for a lot of people to get all upset. And then as things go through the official channels, finally it gets to the king, and he says, we need to proclaim a fast. And he makes a declaration that the city is supposed to enter into mourning. But Jonah has just come into town. He's spoken with a lower official, and then unbeknownst to him, he tells one person, and the message is throughout the city. Jonah was probably thinking, okay, I'll give this message, and then the king will hear it. I'll talk with the king, and we'll see what happens. But this has caught Jonah completely off guard. He wouldn't be expecting the news to be traveling around the city of Nineveh as fast as it did. So that now brings us up to verses 7 through 9. The king proclaimed a decree that everyone was to mourn and to repent from the violence that was in their hand, in the hope, not the certainty, but the hope. This is a hype, I hope so kind of hope, that God would relent from destroying Nineveh. Verses 7 through 9. And he, the king, caused it to be proclaimed and published throughout Nineveh by decree of the king and his nobles, saying, let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink water, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth and cry mightily to God. Yes, let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that is in his hands. Who can tell if God will turn and relent and turn away from his fierce anger so that we may not perish? The king has no trouble believing this message because he's been hearing a lot of bad reports. All of his astrologers, everybody's been saying things like, oh, that solar eclipse, that earthquake. They're all saying that you're a dead man and we're going to be losing all of our battles. And lo and behold, they have been losing battles. They haven't been sending out their troops to fight offensively. They've been having to put down revolts. They've been having plagues and famines and everything else. And now it's finally, okay, I finally have someone who's able to tell me why God is angry. The God of Israel, of all places, is angry with us. So he wants everyone to fast, but notice, he says, let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that is in his hands. We might be thinking about violence on a very limited scale and be thinking about that which goes on within the city of Nineveh. But you have to ask the question, why would God send a prophet of Israel to talk to Nineveh about some internal affairs of some Gentile nation 600 miles away from Israel? The violence that was in their hand, I think, is their foreign policy. They wanted to be on the move, and Assyria was known for that. And I think one of the places they wanted to get to was Israel. They have been having so many problems that they haven't been able to launch those kinds of strikes, but right now at this point, I think the king becomes convinced that they need to pull back from that. They need to pull back from some of the attacks that they had planned. And it's interesting. The 7 years before Jonah's arrival, God had stopped through all of these problems, the plagues, the famines, the revolts, the attacks from Urartu, the solar eclipse, the earthquake. He stopped through all of that. They didn't have opportunity to go and attack other countries. But that period of 7 years made them ripe to receive a warning against their expansionist ways. I suspect that Israel was in their sights. They wanted to get that far west. Actually, that far south, because their territory did extend to the Mediterranean further north from Israel. They had a new king in 744 BC, and at that time, they resumed their old aggressive foreign policy. 22 years later, they destroyed Israel. And then they came under discipline, ultimately with Nineveh being conquered in 612 BC. But I think that God has enforced a lull. And now with Jonah, he's saying, I want you to voluntarily extend the lull. Put in a ceasefire. Stop this aggressive, expansionist foreign policy. And they were spared. We have an interesting decree. We don't know the name of the king because the king assumed that everyone would know who he was. But it was sent to a governor, and this governor we know became governor in 793 BC. People could hold those types of reigns for many years. So it's quite possible that this decree went out at the same time that the king has told everyone to repent and to mourn, to repent from the violence that is in their hands. Decree of the king, you and all the people, your land, your meadows, will mourn and pray for 3 days before the god Adad and repent. You will perform the purification rites so that there might be rest. And one has to wonder, is this a response to Jonah? Many people think so, and no one has been able to disprove it. But notice, if that is what the king said, the king is still a polytheist, isn't he? King doesn't think that the God of Israel is the God. When it says that they repented, I'm not talking about that they believed the gospel that gave everlasting life, but it is talking about they ceased and desisted from a foreign policy that was going to get them into a lot of trouble with God. And Jonah was piping angry over this, as we know, in chapter 4. But I think as he had time to sit down and think about it, he came to realize that it was a lot better for God to stop Assyria from attacking Israel prematurely and not to have to destroy them now because of destroying Israel. And I think that that's the thing that made it so that Jonah was able to write this book. Verse 9 tells us that God saw that Nineveh had turned from its violence and he did not destroy Nineveh. Then God saw their works. Notice he isn't seeing their faith, he's seeing their works. They believed that God was going to destroy it, so they repented from their violence. That they turned from their evil ways, particularly their violent foreign policy, and God relented from the disaster that he said he would bring upon them, and he did not do it. And interestingly, Urartu stopped having as much success, and it wasn't long before Urartu was shrinking. Now, Nothing in this book has told us that Jonah's message is how to have everlasting life. His message was one of telling Nineveh that God was ready to destroy them because of their foreign policy. And if we turn to Matthew chapter 12, verse 11, we won't see any indication that the message was otherwise. Jesus says to people that have heard him speak, the men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and indeed a greater than Jonah is here. He's saying with the amount of light that they had, God brought that earthquake. He brought that solar eclipse. He brought the famines. He brought the plagues. He brought the military reversals. He brought the revolts. And he brought death warmed over. He brought Jonah to them. But he said, they responded to that. And Israel in Jesus' day had a whole lot more light than the people of Nineveh. But he's saying, you're not responding to the light that you've had, and they're going to be able to testify against you that if they had had that much light, they certainly would have responded. But notice, Jesus doesn't say that the men of Nineveh were told anything about everlasting life. Jonah went into town. He talked with a lower official. He probably fulfilled his 3 days, and then he went out and he sat, and he looked to see if God was going to destroy the city. I don't really think that Jonah spent much time giving much of a message beyond what he had initially said. We've been told by many people that there were over 100,000 believers there in Nineveh, and I just don't see the evidence. The text is silent about such things. Conclusion on this passage is one that God is able to do what is absolutely astounding. People were amazed that Alexander could ride Bucephalus, that horse that no one could ride, that was afraid of the shadow of the rider. God knew what would speak to the people of Nineveh. God knew what would address them, and he was able to change their whole perspective on things without having to wipe them out. They could have some defeats against Urartu. They could have some revolts. They could have some plagues. They could have an earthquake. They could have a solar eclipse. They could have famines. And then Jonah came into town. Would anyone have thought that one man could walk in, probably speak with one lower official, and change the foreign policy of a great nation? That's even more astounding than Alexander writing Bucephalus. Conclusion. When Jonah told the king's representative of God's judgment against Nineveh, word spread through the whole city and general mourning occurred. The king made a decree of mourning for the people and urged them to give up their violence. I think he's there talking to the military leaders and so forth, that God might relent, which he did. God was gracious to Jonah. God was gracious to the Assyrians, and God was also gracious to the northern kingdom of Israel. That's the message that we see out of this passage. Lester, would you like to close us in prayer and then lead us in prayer? Okay, sure.
I guess we have not the fall of the northern kingdom at this time.
No, they fell in 722. So Jonah was able to go back there, and I think by the time he got back there, he got straightened out, and I can imagine he had a very interesting message for the nation as a result of this.
I guess what was our reason that Jonah did not want to go there to hear the gospel?
I think that Jonah, because the book of Hosea had already been written, I think that he was probably thinking it would be better for him to die and to not let Assyria get spared, because he knew that they were going to have a role in the destruction of Israel. And I think he didn't want that to happen, so he thought that if God were planning to destroy them, if he didn't give the message, it would be good for God to destroy Assyria.
Number two. Now, in Isaiah, he talks about that God is not only the God of Israel, but the God of the Gentiles as well. Kind of like a paraphrase there.
Yep.
In Isaiah. Wouldn't one infer that God would be giving the gospel message here too? Because Israel is the kingdom priest.
God desired for Israel to do that. But Israel didn't do all that good a job. And Jonah doesn't look like he's really spending much time in Nineveh. So we have silence as to whether he gave them a message of everlasting life. We might find out that he said some things along that line. But that's not the message that we're told that he was commissioned with. And nothing that Jesus says gives us an indication. So it's one of those things we're going to find out later.